News stories are filled with tales of risk and uncertainty. We're told the probable chance of a weather event or how likely it is we might contract an illness. There's an art to telling stories of uncertainty that provide context and nuance that are often missing. That's the focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association in partnership with Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. Joining me, as always, is regular panelist John Baylor, Emeritus Professor of Statistics at Miami University. Our guest today is Sir David Spiegelhalter. Spiegelhalter is Emeritus Professor of Statistics in the Center for Mathematical Sciences at the University of Cambridge. Spiegelhalter also serves as non-executive director of the UK Statistics Authority. He's presented BBC documentaries and published a number of books, including Sex by Numbers, The Art of Statistics, and COVID by Numbers. He's here today to talk about his new book, The Art of Uncertainty, How to Navigate Chance, Ignorance, Risk, and Luck. David, thank you so much for joining us again for your fourth time?
Five time. Do I get a prize? I mean,
the opportunity for a sixth.
Exactly. I'm so delighted to be back on the show, as they say.
Well, you know, so the natural question is, you know, this book, you know, I saw it in the airport. I mean, I'm not worthy to be talking to you, David. I'm talking to an airport book author. So what is it that inspired the writing of this book?
Oh, because I could, because I Art of Statistics has been really successful. 11 languages sold, hundreds of thousands of copies, and et cetera. And once you've done that, your publisher will pretty well take anything. They love you. So I thought this is a really great opportunity to write about a lot of the stuff I've been interested in all my professional life, which is about uncertainty and probability and chance and risk and all those things that we deal with both professionally and personally. And so I was very pleased that they accepted the proposal, and I got a good advance, which is even very nicer, and I actually then wrote the thing. It's a bit long because it was edited down, but I had so much I wanted to put into it. And trying to keep the maths out, of course, and trying to make it story-driven, which we might come on to. So trying to find a story to illustrate each of the things that I was, wanting, the lessons I was trying to put over.
So I think there are lots of understandings of what uncertainty and risk are that are not statistical understandings. And so as you were writing this book, what audience were you thinking of? And I guess, how were you imagining this engaging with other understandings of what risk and uncertainty are?
Yeah, I wanted it for people who were interested in risk and uncertainty. So in the word risk, as we know, is, I think, almost meaningless. And I try to keep away from it on the whole because it means everything to everybody. But there are a huge number of people working in this general area in what you might call risk management or risk assessment, et cetera, modelers, a lot of bureaucracies. And so I was hoping to, in a way, raise the level of the discussion about what we meant by the chance of something happening or the probability of something happening, how we might go around assessing that, the relative role of modeling against subjective judgment, and so on, things that I've been involved in for decades, and which I still think need some clarification. And the uncertainty as the overriding risk is, I regard as just a subset of dealing with uncertainty, like luck and coincidences and chance and all these things that we talk about in our life. And so I stole the definition of uncertainty that I use from somewhere, and is the conscious awareness of ignorance. And I love that because it, for a start, it brings it right back to the subject. That uncertainty, what I push throughout the book, is a relationship between you and the outside world. It's not necessarily a property of the outside world, except possibly at the quantum level, which I try to avoid because it's all a bit bonkers. But in terms of, the life that we live, what we're daily exposed to, our concerns about the future, basically we're ignorant about what's going to happen. I mean, it may be already predetermined. It may be the will of God. Who cares? I don't have to bother to argue about that because whatever it is, we're uncertain about it. And we're also ignorant about most of what's going on at the moment, and we're very ignorant about what's happened in the past and why it happened. So we live our life in a tiny bubble of knowledge surrounded by this sort of ocean of ignorance. And that's a natural human condition. I think it's great. I think it's wonderful. I can't think of anything else. I can't think of anything worse than knowing what's going to happen. So so one of my, as I try to emphasize sometimes to publicists, that it's not a self-help book. But I think there are some quite useful lessons in it. And it actually changed my life writing the book, I have to say.
Oh, well, that
I want to, wait a minute. John, I want to know how it changed your life.
That was my question. Yeah.
Great minds.
Yeah, I think it was, right at the beginning of the book, I talk about, my grandfather only surviving in the First World War. And otherwise, I wouldn't be here if a shell had landed slightly closer to him. And all the other threads, ways in which I so easily could not have been born. My mother was captured by pirates in the South China Sea in the 1930s. My father nearly died of TB after the Second World War, and so on and so on. And then I actually researched the context of my conception. I mean, it's worth thinking about. Most people don't think about it because the idea of their parents sort of doing it is difficult, not just for teenagers, I think, but everybody. But my parents have died now, so I thought I can face this. And it was in November 1952, it must have been, and I know where they were living, in this little pretty unheated stone cottage in North Devon. And I researched the weather. It was one of the coldest Novembers for years. It's a huge cold snap, made the newspapers. So I know that they were shivering away in this place. And so I just assumed they kind of maybe wanted to get a bit warmer, and here I am. So it's this, it's also known as existential luck. The fact that I'm here at all is a matter of staggering what I call chain of micro contingencies, which it so easily might not have happened. And by thinking through this, it's just put me really, I feel myself really in perspective. I'm nothing. I'm just a chance, occurrence in a sequence of events that could easily have gone a different way. So it's really, we probably don't want to get into this. It's changed my philosophy of life.
Well, that's what the show's all about, is philosophy of life. So so speaking as another just outcome from a whole string of components that led in the sequence to me, I'm just delighted to have you here reflecting on this with us. You've done a great job with bringing story into descriptions. And, it was no surprise to me that Casanova was a probabilist,
Oh, yeah, that was, I mean, I wanted to, I mean, I find, I want, I do have a chapter on probability, and I thought I've got to get, factorials and permutations and combinations in. I got to find, and I hate that stuff. It's just counting. It's nothing to do with probability, and yet it bores everyone's senses, I think, as part of probability classes. But I had to do it because I had to show how you can actually calculate the probability, assuming randomness, of things occurring. And then I'd read Steve Stigler's book on Casanova's lottery about, before the French Revolution, Casanova came along and to the French state and said, I can organize a lottery for you that is not guaranteed to make money on every draw, but will make money on the long run, because he could do the odds. 90 bought 90 tickets, and only, 75 were chosen, and you could choose two or three, four, five numbers and then get paid out an appropriate return if you got that, if that your numbers were included in the five. And he worked out the odds, which has been a basic combinatorics, but he got it right. And the lottery had a decent payout, bigger than the UK National Lottery at the moment, for example. They were paying out about 75% or something like that. But it still made a huge amount of money, went on for decades. 4% of the national state income came from it at one point, only interrupted in the Revolutionary Terror, but then started again afterwards. And I thought it was a great story. I mean, I kept it pretty short because I think stories can go on too long. But I thought it was fascinating. Yeah.
How did you decide what stories you were going to use? Because I know in one of the chapters you talk about what the Bay of Pigs.
Oh, yeah.
And it was so interesting sort of seeing what stories you were using to kind of launch into this conversation. Yeah. That I sometimes didn't expect.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I realized I had been collecting these in my mind anyway for a long time. And I don't know where I wanted an example of where there'd been a real failure because people had used words instead of numbers. And I'd read somewhere, but I then got this wonderful book with Charles Wyler on the Bay of Pigs, where he interviewed everybody afterwards as a post-mortem. And you know, we know there was it was a CIA planned invasion by 1,500 Cuban exiles in 1961 of Cuba, and Kennedy found out about it and only got for when he was inaugurated and appointed the Joint Chiefs of Staff committee to investigate it, and they thought it was a really bad idea, and they actually said it was, you know, roughly 30% chance of success, 70% chance of failure. But in the report that went to Kennedy, that the numbers came out and it got replaced by the phrase a fair chance, which is disastrous. Only I'm sure it's not the only reason. There was a whole lot of groupthink and everything like that, but Kennedy did approve it, and it was a total disaster fiasco. And what I point out is that intelligence agencies have learned about that. In the UK now, if you think that something's got a 30% chance of success, it has to be described as unlikely if you work for MI5 or MI6 or the UK intelligence. There's a scale. I got a mug with this because I gave a talk at MI5 and they gave me a mug. All I got was this lousy mug, and which has got the scale on there. So likely means between 55% and 80% and things like that. Or 55 to 75% is likely, and so on. And so, you know, the other story I used when probabilities were used in an intelligence operation was when it was thought that Osama bin Laden was in the compound in Abbottabad in 50 years, exactly 50 years after the Bay of Pigs, and in 2011, and President Obama had multiple independent teams assess the evidence and come up with numbers. And he said afterwards, well, some thought it's 80 to 90% chance he was there. Some thought it's, I shouldn't use chance, really, 80 to 90% probability he was there. Some said 30 to 40%. You know, I got all these divergence of opinions, a lot of uncertainty. I thought it was roughly about 50-50, and he went for it, and it was the right decision. Well, except for Osama bin Laden, maybe. So these are great stories, I think. Really, really resonate, and I don't know where they came from. I think I just collect them, and I'm wondering how can I find a story to illustrate a particular point.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking with Sir David Spiegelhalter about his new book, The Art of Uncertainty: How to Navigate Chance, Ignorance, Risk, and Luck.
You know, it's you know, I'm glad you've been bringing up these examples because I thought those were really great. You know, because I didn't really know that backstory of the Bay of Pigs and sort of that you know fair chance for 30%. And you know, would you bet on that? And I also you include other things like mapping of probabilities to terms such as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And those words like likely, unlikely, likely, very likely. It's That just allows for such a subjective mapping of how much you think that
Well,
means.
it's not as subjective as if you don't have a mapping. So I think that the IPCC have really led with a scale for translating words to numbers, so that it means that within the text they can use words, but they're constantly reminding you at the bottom of the page what how the to say something is likely or very likely, what they actually mean. And lots of people, there's a lovely NATO document about variants of vague verbiage, which is about all the different scales that people have developed in there for this, largely intelligence community, but IPCC and others. IPCC one is now being more widely used by many people. So, you know, there's about seven different versions of what likely means, but they're all roughly the sort of say about 50 to 80% sort of feeling. So I think this is a real step forward, because it means that you're not trying to make people think of precise probabilities. That would be ridiculous. You're just allowing people to give it vague ranges, but at least it should stop the worst misunderstandings.
Yeah, this resonated because when I was in grad school, I knew a professor of cognitive psychology that was working with people in the army at the time about what does likely mean. You know, if you say that we're likely to encounter, you know, an enemy in some position, what does that mean? And that was a real that's a hard question to go from that kind of subjective ordering to what it really means for them. So are you so it sounds like you're this is one aspect of best practice. If you're going to be reporting these kinds of, you know, suggestive, these words that
Yeah,
suggest.
exactly. If you're going to be making some if you're going to make subjective assessments of uncertainty, these are all subjective judgments, then I think it's really good to be able to put a number on them, even a rough one. Now, of course, which is what I also discussed, super forecasting competitions and so on, where you're making a judgment about in 6 months' time what would be the, you know, what would be the state of the Ukraine-Russian war, etc., etc. Now there, they don't just use rough numbers; they will use really quite precise numbers, and the real good super forecasters are able to distinguish between 73% and 75% likely. I think they become so expert at it. And the thing I really push in the book is the fact that these numbers, you know, we'd be pulled out of someone's head. They're constructed. They're not true. They're not like you could measure these things. They're judgments based on the individual's knowledge. But you can check how good they are using the idea of scoring rules. And so, you know, essentially it's squared error loss. You penalize by the square of the error you make. And that was developed by Glenn Breyer, weather meteorologist in 1951 in the States, when they started doing probability of precipitation. 1951, yeah, long time ago, 75 years they've been doing that. And that using that scoring, well, it's still used for weather forecasters, and it's used for super forecasters. And the book, I give a little quiz showing how you can use it to measure your own probability judgments, the measures of your ignorance. And I think I do this with audiences a lot to show that they can quantify their ignorance. I just give them almanac questions. The one I used recently, what's got the biggest population, Cambridge, UK or Cambridge in Massachusetts? And so there's one I use locally, and they have to say, well, you know, which do they think? Well, I think it might be UK. How sure are you? Are you sure? 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 sure, and things like that. And then you score. And using the squared error loss, if you say 10 out of 10 Cambridge UK and you're right, you get 25. And if you're wrong, you lose 75. So squared error loss is really quite a vicious way of, it prevents people from overconfidence. It avoids overconfidence. And I think I'm so pleased to get, I really wanted to get that into a book and raise the profile of that idea that just because judgments are subjective, they can still be numerical and they can still be tested about how good they are.
I just want to state for the record that I missed most of the questions on that quiz in the book.
Oh, good. They were supposed to be difficult. The issue is, though, did you know you didn't know and said, I don't know, or did you make a stab at it and get a huge negative score?
I thought I knew more than I did. And I think right. The point you make in the book is that sort of that penalizes. Yeah,
that's what it's supposed to
really,
train
yeah.
You out.
Yeah.
It's supposed to train you out of those that sort yeah. of overconfidence. Yeah.
Yes, I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
That's, you know, you've been involved in kind of promoting good communication, and particularly in the context of risk throughout your career. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, this is a natural and important response to these questions of what is misinformation or disinformation. And you know, how can you help us first tell us a little bit about that distinction, how you define that distinction? And then how does that play out as you start to think about how do we communicate in a way that really reflects what we know?
Yeah, I mean, I think simplistically, you might say disinformation is deliberately being misleading or actually telling lies or something like that, but deliberately knowing you're doing it in order to manipulate people. And misinformation is when, for one reason or another, you're giving misleading information. It may just be an honest mistake. You may just be forwarding something that came from somebody else, but you actually, you know, to all extent, do believe it, but it's not right. And you're spreading it around, which is a lot of social media is like that. I think that people actually do believe what they're promoting.
In the book, you have this whole section where you're talking about how we engage in trustworthy communication, which obviously is really important when we're talking about things like uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Could you talk us through those pointers that you've identified and maybe apply it to an actual case?
Yeah. I feel very strongly about it. And I'm, you know, spending now a good amount of time with the team I was working with, of psychologists and communication professionals, on this idea of trustworthy communication. And it's based on the, you know, first observation is that, you know, we as scientists go around saying, oh, we want people to trust us. We want to be trusted. We want to be trusted. And I learned from this philosopher, Honora Neal, the philosopher of Kant. Not that I've ever read any Kant, but she points out that this is the wrong question. It's not what you should be aiming for. You know, you should be, your aim should be to demonstrate trustworthiness. It's up to you to earn that trust if people want to offer it up to you. But the crucial thing is that you have to demonstrate it, not try to persuade someone to trust you. Now, in fact, our research suggests that if you do demonstrate trustworthiness, people do trust you more, which is really nice. But that's not the main aim. That is almost a byproduct of just acting well in an honorable way. And so, which of course then it asks you, she identifies that someone, if you're trying to assess whether someone's trustworthy, they should be honest, competent, and reliable, and features like that. But trustworthy communication, I think, is a particular issue that, you know, we studied and other people have studied, and particularly, as you'd mentioned, in the face of uncertainty. That's where it belongs in this book. Because, you know, if you absolutely know everything, then you can just tell it. You can try to be engaging, just tell it how it is. But that's not the situation. At the start of COVID, that's not the situation. Climate change, really, not the situation in many areas. We may be pretty certain of some stuff. Other things we're not so certain about. And so how do we do that in a trustworthy way? And we got a paper in Nature, in fact, sort of identifying five general principles that I promote in the book, which is, first of all, you've got to ask yourself, am I trying to persuade somebody or am I trying to inform them? To raise the level of the discussion, empower them to make better decisions. And you really have to be honest with yourself, because some people delude themselves and think, oh, I'm just going to inform people about it. But actually, they're trying to persuade them to act or think in a certain way. Now, I think actually that you, one way you perhaps do want to persuade people is to be interested. So I do think, you know, I got a statement in the book, there's no point in being trustworthy if you're dull. So I think actually trying to engage the audience by telling vivid stories and so on is quite a reasonable thing to do. But all you're doing is trying to get them to engage with the information using all those good journalistic, I wouldn't say tricks, but you know, skills. That some people are very good at. But then one needs to be balanced and talk about the pros and cons, the benefits and harms. When you talk about vaccines, you have to talk about the benefits and harms all the time. But then you have to acknowledge the uncertainties, the things you don't know, and how good your evidence is. Really important, whether actually how much do you believe? You know, how confident are you in all your analysis and your models? That little idea of confidence. And the final one, which is becoming increasingly important, I think, is you've got to preempt misunderstandings. Try to pre-bunk the misinformation. Don't wait to be on the back foot until someone has either deliberately or accidentally misunderstood what the data is saying. So you've got to preempt the misunderstandings. And this is becoming, I think, increasingly recognized. And certainly in my work with the Office for National Statistics and on their website and in the Code of Practice for Statistics in the UK, the idea of getting in there first and really high up in the bulletin or in the website, put this is what the data means, this is what it does not mean. be aware of this, be really careful of this, and not to have it buried. I mean, and the worst thing is when you say, oh, this data should be used with caution. God, no, awful. But that's the sort of typical thing that people might put in there when they know there's some inadequacies in it. No, useless. The warnings, and it has to be right up front, up big print. So as you can tell, I feel quite strongly about this. In the book, I talk about our work on COVID, on communicating benefits and harms of vaccines, and how it was used in the decision on the broadcast, live broadcast on BBC, and with a huge audience, to explain why younger people were no longer being given the AstraZeneca vaccine because of the side effects. And so that always led me also to think, to really dislike this phrase, vaccines are safe and effective, which I regard as being manipulative, because vaccines, well, they're safe enough and effective enough to give to some people in some circumstances. And I think if you don't say that, then if you just say vaccines are safe and effective, that actually, I think, is a very misleading statement to people. And no wonder people get fed up about it. And our research showed that if you actually give a balanced view and saying, well, the vaccines are, you know, they're safe, but they have some problems and these things we're uncertain about, that the more skeptical members of the audience, the ones who are really skeptical about the evidence, trust the source more. So you increase trust in the group who, in a sense, are most skeptical, which means that a standard government message, like it's been used in the UK, vaccines are safe and effective, you should take them, is actively decreasing trust in the group you are most trying to reach. You're making it worse by hammering this message through. You're making it worse. I now do this, say this again and again in front of all, you know, UK civil service or, you know, government audiences. And these principles are now in the Government Communication Service official counter disinformation toolkit, which I'm really pleased about.
You know, these are great. And I, you know, the thing that another aspect of it that I really like is that they also provide kind of a rule of, these are rules that a consumer should be demanding.
Yeah.
From the, this is like, you, if you're not showing me this, you're not giving me what I need. And it's also something that a journalist should be pressing scientists for, pressing, you know, if they're reading this press release, well, tell us, you know, you need to be able to answer these questions. It's almost like this checklist of saying,
exactly. What are the pros and cons? What's your uncertainty? How good is the evidence? What does this not mean? You know, all these, it's very simple things. So I use it all the time when I'm critiquing, when I'm hearing somebody. The other thing I do mention in the book is communication in crises, for example, at the start of COVID, where, you know, everyone's rushing around, a bit of a panic, you know, panic, people don't know a lot. And I used the work of John Krebs, who was head of the Food Standards Agency in the UK. And while he was, he just sort of, every year another disaster came along. He had foot and mouth and mad cow disease and scrapie, every, you know, awful, awful time for agriculture in this, in the country. And he developed a whole playbook that he worked through and wrote about afterwards. And I use this, I got it in my head, and I check everybody in crises that for you, when you're talking to an audience, you first of all say what you do know. This is what we know, confident what we know. Then you say what you don't know. So you bring that uncertainty up front, your ignorance right up front, and admit it. Then you say what you're doing about it, the experiments you're doing, the trials you're doing, and so on, how you can. And then you say what people can do in the meantime. Self-efficacy, you may not want to eat beef at the moment if you want to be on the safe side. We think, actually don't think currently there's much chance of a risk, but you may not want self-efficacy. And the final one, which is the most important one, is we will come back to you and our advice will probably change. In other words, everything we're saying now is provisional based on our current knowledge, but we will learn more and our advice will change. That's one I look out for, and that's the one that politicians are incapable of saying, of using. They have to be absolutely certain. And so in COVID, you know, people were obsessed about washing their hands and wiping surfaces a year later, when we knew within weeks that it was a waste of time, essentially. So it was because they couldn't change their minds. They'd be accused of U-turns and so on, because everything they were saying was delivered with absolute confidence that this is absolutely right and so on. And so when there's a change in mind, change in recommendation, everyone says, oh, well, look, they used to say that and now they're saying that. So this idea of provisionality, I think, is absolutely vital part of communication.
So what's next?
I haven't got anything left. As I said, I think I put, you know, all my, what I could think of into here. And it does cover quite a wide range from these, you know, I got all the stuff on luck and coincidences and randomness and all these things that I'm fascinated by. But then it goes through to risk management, what I'm interested in is deep uncertainty, because we're used to risk analysis, and we, you know, when we teach this stuff, we say, oh, well, you list the options and then you look at all the possible outcomes and their probabilities under each outcome, and then you give them values, and then you apply, you look for maximize expected value, and think, because this is complete nonsense in real life. You can never do this in any really difficult problem. You don't know what the values are. You don't even know what the possibilities are. What are the possible futures? And we live in I think it would not be exaggerating to say we are living in an age of uncertainty at the moment, even more than for some time. Maybe not as much as the 1930s, but I think we're in a big age of uncertainty at the moment. And so I think that where you can't, it's difficult even to list the possibilities of what might happen. And so we're in the situation of what people call deep uncertainty, where actually the sort of the usual analytic way that we teach is really going to struggle. And so I do talk quite a lot about how you can still try to quantify, you can try to use your imagination. The Ministry of Defense, UK Ministry of Defense, employs science fiction writers to come up with stuff. They're good short stories. They're really good. They publish them saying, this is not an official recommendation of the Ministry of Defense or whatever. And they're good stories. So, you know, just what I might call imagineering, trying to think. It's like the other thing the Ministry of Defense do is really emphasize the idea of red teaming. a bit like Barack Obama had with his team that said there's only a 30 to 40% chance that bin Laden was in the compound. That sounds like a red team, people who really set out to be pessimistic, go counter any group, think of what could go wrong, to be rather pessimistic. And again, the UK Ministry of Defence really promote the idea of red teaming. So I think these are good ideas, almost both as an individual. Yeah, I mean, Michelin said you should have a one person red team. You should have a red team in your mind, which tries to counter your confirmation bias, which tries to counter the group think, the influences, and which the people being really successful in super forecasting competitions have been found to be essentially red, one person red teams, because they are aware of their own biases. They look for deliberately try to find evidence that might counter the way things, the usual ways in which people are describing things. And those are the people who are best at forecasting.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. David, thank you so much for being here again, and I look forward to you coming back for a sixth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'd better knock out another book, I suppose.
Thanks, David.
Thank you very much.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. You can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other places where you find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.